I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. As the new year gets underway, we all turn our attention to the future. But for our guests today, it's their job to think about the future and its implications for cities and for businesses 365 days a year. Tara LeMay is founder and CEO of Lens, a network of leading thinkers focused on strategic innovation. Tara is attempting to help urban leaders adopt the ways of venture capitalists to innovate their way to the future. Jody Turner is founder and CEO of Culture of Future, where she tries to make trends from a fuzzy future clearer for companies like Nike, Starbucks, and IDEO. Understanding the future is our topic today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Tara LeMay is founder and CEO of Lens, a network of leading thinkers focused on strategic innovation. She works with the boards and leadership of Fortune 2000 companies such as Nokia and Intel on innovation and next-generation strategies. Tara, you are a member of the Markle Task Force on National Security in the Information Age, where you chair the Technology Committee. Is national security even possible in an information age?
I think national security is more possible in the information age, given how many resources we have to data and data flows. One of the things that's challenging for government is they're not used to really tapping into the resources of technology. So as the market writ large, including the challenges to national security, have become more technically sophisticated, the other side of the house is making the government as sophisticated as the potential harmers are.
Has government been able to respond in a timely way? I mean, has it been able to get up to speed in the way it needs to?
No, it hasn't. Although we've been very successful in working with the government, both Congress and the White House, in moving forward the possibility for making technology platforms effective in the post-9/11 environment. Unfortunately, the way procurement works for the government and acquisition of technology, we're still well behind where we need to be. I think we have to start to look at it a little bit differently, much more modularly, much more organic, on the fly, and let small groups do the kind of innovation that they need to, just like happens in the private sector.
As you've pointed out, addressing the issue of security, like so many issues we confront, requires large-scale innovation. What are the conditions necessary for large-scale innovation?
Well, I like to call it vast innovation, because the innovation is not its usual small steps forward. It's really fundamentally rethinking things. I think one of the critical issues around it is getting beyond the existing dogma. Frequently, what we've seen having meetings with the various players and trying in the Markle process to bring innovation forward is that people didn't even know that they were stuck in old models. They didn't even realize why they were taking some of the actions that they were. So one of the critical issues for vast innovation in this front is to start to think about it from an outcomes perspective. What do you want it to look like in the future? One of the things we do at Lens is we call them postcards from the future. So we say, if you were going to send a postcard back from 5 years, what would it look like? And then once you see that, you can really start to understand what kind of innovations or small steps would put you in that direction.
And so you're talking about innovation in two ways, it seems. Vast innovation, but also small steps. Reconcile that for me.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of folks who want innovation, they want it now. They want all of it now. Even in the private sector, they say, I want a, you know, $10 billion market and I want it now. The reality is fundamental shifts in innovation, very disruptive innovation, large-scale innovation, happen quickly, but they happen starting with small steps. What starts to happen is little tiny bets or little tiny options are placed so that people start to say, where's that movement? Where's the direction going? It's sort of like birds flocking. They take off a few times. heading in different directions until they build up some momentum. And then when that momentum happens, it carries straight through and it brings brings the entire flock moving forward, just like innovation. Once something catches on fire after they've made enough small bets or enough organic movement, then all of a sudden it'll catch on fire and it'll make that very large-scale change happen within a fairly rapid period of time after that. So it scales up quickly, but you have to start with small steps.
Given the conditions you've described necessary for innovation, where is the gap the greatest?
It's very difficult for governments to take small steps. Frequently, I think both the procurement process and bond issues and the way government approaches creating new projects make them think about things large from the get-go. Instead of looking at how do we test different ideas, how do we partner for small-scale rapid failure? In the private sector, we like to think of it as very rapid prototyping, very rapid failure, so that the successes percolate up. And then once we have those successes, you can fund them and go forward. It's difficult, I think, especially for government, to really rethink that part of the process.
And what are the systems or the processes, the rules in place that prevent that taking of small steps?
Well, I think a lot of times it has to do with, again, how monies are allocated. Frequently, they go through a request for proposal or a referendum kind of approach that has a very large allocation of assets against it. What I would suggest is they take a much more portfolio approach to it to say, what are the largest challenges we're dealing with? What are the obstacles and barriers for us to be successful and have a fundamentally different way of solving some of the most important problems? And then use some of the funds from a portfolio perspective and say, where are we putting our bets? Where can we take some risks? Where can we create some new opportunity? Instead of saying we've agreed on a particular proposal in a particular direction and we're going to put all of our funds against that.
You prepared a DVD for CEOs for Cities members describing this kind of approach to investing in cities. Tell me more about the innovation model that you recommend for urban leaders.
Well, one of the things that we do with the commercial sector is we have an approach called options. And options are a lot like movie studios putting little options on potential scripts for the future, or like baseball teams, you know, having a minor league so that they're betting little amounts on players that are up-and-comers. The way we look at options, and I think city leaders can look at options, is to say, how can we place small bets in areas where we need fundamental innovation happening? So the question I would say for these leaders is, what are your biggest challenges, and where would you like to see innovation happen? How can you explore those areas? How can you bring in people who may not have been thinking about the problem the same way as you? And take a look at what you're currently allocating your resources towards. I think take a look at your portfolio of spending. And then really brainstorm where you can put some small bets, little tiny bets on things. So, you know, maybe well under $1 million, frequently more in the $100,000 range maybe, or just a pilot project happening somewhere. Once you do those, you can see what those successes might look like. What are the pilots? How are they working? And then you fund up incrementally. Or you create an options challenge that says, boy, we have this problem that we want to solve. Here's our postcard from the future. In our future community, we might be a leader in a particular kind of healthcare, or we might be a leader in alternative energy, biofuels and renewables. How would we work backwards from that to incent, place small bets now so that we have the ability to be there in 5 years or 7 years? And that's a different approach than many cities take for really getting to fundamental change.
You've raised two questions for me, Tara. How does a venture capitalist know that something is going to scale? Something that where you see a small success, that can be turned into a large success and scale will not be an issue?
Well, a lot of times the question as we like to put it in the venture community, is the dog eating the dog food. So is the market buying it? Is there market acceptance? So in the case of a project, are there enough people who are participating in a program? Is there a particular uptake? Can you create processes so that you can engage a large number of people? In the technology space, for example, you may have set code in a particular way to test things. You might have created a prototype set of technology just to see how it worked. And once you got the results and said, boy, this is working, people are exchanging information this way, this system works for them, you might invest a lot of money to rewrite that code so that it can handle 100,000 or a million people instead of maybe the 1,000 that you had in your initial piece. So for a city project, in their initial program, they may do it a rapid way. They may do it very quickly. And the real question is, are people accepting this and is this making change happen? Once you understand that that's the case, then you ask yourself the question, what do we need to do to make sure we can handle the large number of people or the large number of transactions that we're going to have to manage? But the biggest question is it working? Because if it's working, you can find a way to make it scale.
Well, the other question is, how do you get people to admit failure or to evaluate failure honestly in a way that's helpful? And then on top of that, do it in the public realm.
Well, I think that what you have to do up front is to say that you expect failure and you plan for it. As a longtime entrepreneur myself, I like to say that I fail hourly. And by planning on failing hourly, if I miss my mark, I know I'm not trying hard enough. So one of the things I think to do is to state publicly that you're going to be taking a lot of interesting steps in different directions to see what works. And we expect a lot of failure. But what we also expect in those failures is very rapid analysis of why the failure happened and very you know, you have to create a criteria set that says, boy, this didn't work and here's why. It can't be so rigid that you say, oh, it failed and we'll never try anything like this again, which I think is frequently what happens. A pretty good idea didn't work in one implementation, but they didn't say, what can we learn from this failure and how can we take it on again? So publicly stating you expect to be experimenting, look at them as hypotheses, look at them as experiments, engage the stakeholder community to play in those experiments, and share with them the portfolio of experiments that are happening in that space.
Experiments it's an interesting way to look at it versus expecting to fail. So I can imagine being able to sell that to citizenry. It's difficult to think about my child in school, you're experimenting and you expect to fail. You know, there are human costs to failure in the public realm that don't exist if you don't quite get the technology right and, you know, you've got a chance to iterate. Have you thought about what that means? I mean, have you factored that into your advice to urban leaders and offer some comfort or a perspective on that that would make sense, again, in the public realm?
Well, I think that it's important to have minimum expectations. Again, drawing back on a venturing type of model, frequently we have tranching of funding. And we say, boy, you need to get to this step before we fund your next step forward. I think in things like education, what you really want to set up is to say, this is the minimum criteria we expect from here and to be testing it on an ongoing basis. And that's why I say, if you're constantly testing for rapid prototyping and rapid success, you don't wait until the school year is over before you find out a new program's not working. You actually find out within a month or 6 weeks and say, how do we remedy this situation? But by not testing anything at all and not exploring the edges, you're really locked into a system that you know is broken. And so I think there's a bit of a trade-off there. I would also say this is a place where one of the lessons from entrepreneurship and new business models come into play. There's this notion of co-creation. And co-creation is really a different way of looking at design and development. A good example of it that I like to talk about is the Lego model. When Lego Mindstorms came out, Lego thought that they were not going to share the code with anyone. they said, boy, people are starting to hack into our product and we don't like it. And, you know, this has been making us very uncomfortable. All of a sudden, they realized those people who were writing new code were actually their smartest, best users, and that that code was a valuable part of their new product. And so they created an open platform for development and ideation and creation with them. And we see that happening in a lot of markets. I think the notion of co-creation, particularly in schools, is very critical because I think it's a co-creation between the government officials who are participating, the parents and the students, developing the model together and really spending a lot of time saying what's working and what's not working here and evolving it as you go along. So don't look at it as a one-time long-term event with failure. Look at it as a ongoing, how do we make this fundamentally different?
It's an interesting example you choose to illustrate co-creation when you think about education. And most educators would tell you that they work very hard to get parents involved in schools. But parents' lives today, either disaffected with society or working two or three jobs to keep up, many parents of low to moderate income, which, of course, is the situation with many, many public school students in urban areas, parental involvement is quite difficult. And often when it does occur, it is hostile. I'm wondering have you had a situation with, let's say, a corporate environment where you had to change the culture so that it embraces rapid failure and experimentation and begins to use co-creation as a principle of responsibility for the employees in the company?
Well, I think one of the most interesting examples that I've engaged in discussion with the company on and spoke to many of their employees is some of the eBay issues. I think eBay is an interesting co-creation environment because the entire eBay platform is co-created with its buyers and sellers.
Yes.
And eBay never decides a new category. The buyers and sellers decide. So if something bubbles up in other and all of a sudden becomes more important, then the eBay employees say, okay, time for a new category here. They really try to find out what's needed and required from their most active users. So they created a listening organization called Voices, where they have groups of 10 buyers and sellers on conference calls on a weekly basis with senior leaders in the company to get that input. What I think is interesting about eBay, and again goes back to the parent situation, is what they chose were their most active buyers and sellers. So they don't choose the people who are time-pressed for other things or maybe occasional users, or it's really not a priority for them. What they said is if our active users are really putting a lot of pressure on the system, they really want it to work for them, we will work with them because if we optimize for them in a co-creation process, we've optimized for the others who may not have the time to participate. And I think when the schools are looking at this, they certainly have some parents who are active and engaged in different environments that may be creating these voices like environments for them to participate in a pretty simple way to get their feedback there on an ongoing basis, who act as a proxy for the larger group. In the eBay case, they bring these Voices members together once a year to have an in-person environment with people from all over. I think it's a really interesting example. What's also interesting about the eBay's example is because they do so much in this co-creation with their users and all of their transactions and how much people bought and sold are available on the internet, they basically have a very transparent environment. And that transparency in business is a lot like the transparency in government, that, you know, having the public meetings, having the open dialogue, having sunshine laws or documents being ready for the public, and having a very active and aggressive stakeholdership is much more akin to government than it is to normal private sector business. So I think there are interesting lessons there to be learned.
Yeah, I agree. That's a very interesting example and analogy that can be used in the public, in the public sector. Let me ask you, Tara, how do you explain the growing interest worldwide in innovation?
I think that we have reached the edge of what we can do. Well, Let me back up and say this. I think that we like to live in the world that's most possible while we're alive, and we're realizing that innovation makes those possibilities happen. I also think that innovation creates new markets and new opportunities, and old markets are starting to die off and change with the advent of the communications technologies that we have. People are becoming more active, more involved. Their priorities are really shifting. One of the big shifts that we're seeing is the shift to a support economy. There's a terrific piece of work done by Shoshana Zuboff, who was a prof at the Harvard Business School, on our movement away from the industrial age, where the middle class was starting to create a material-based market, into a support economy. As you pointed out, a lot of people are taxed with too many things to do and not enough time. There's a real trend towards using that new technology to support people and to give them some freedom of time and space, whether it's helping them work through the pile of insurance documents they have, or helping them find childcare or other resources. And I think we're going to see a lot more innovation that starts to happen at the edge of the services space in that area. And also the advent of biotechnology and nanotechnology is going to change the nature of stuff. And we're going to have a whole new world of interaction with stuff soon.
When you think about this worldwide movement toward innovation, let me ask you, where are the mistakes most often made?
I think frequently there are a number of areas where we make mistakes. One big area is we don't really think about the implications for the larger public. And so frequently the public dialogue doesn't happen until after the fact, and we have to readjust based on that. And having more conversation up front, I think, is extremely useful. In the early days of genetics research, there was a lot of public dialogue and public debate. There are a number of organizations now, such as Gene Forum in Portland, talking about what the communities or cities are looking for in ethics policies and guidelines for new technologies and innovations. I think that as we lean heavily into innovation, we should also lean heavily into public discussion and dialogue.
Tara, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tara LeMay is founder and CEO of Lens. After a short break, we'll talk with Jody Turner about her work with clients like Nike, Starbucks, and IDEO on trends and design-based strategies. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. It's time to check in with Nate Berg of Planetizen.com to get the highlights from 2006 in the world of urban planning, design, and development.
In 2006, eminent domain was one of the most significant planning and development issues. The Supreme Court's 2005 decision in the case of Kelo versus New London, Connecticut, gave local governments increased power to acquire land through eminent domain if it constituted a benefit to the general public. As a result, local officials and developers across the nation pounced on the opportunity to improve their city's economies by acquiring land and developing revenue-generating commercial projects. But some landowners questioned the extent of the public benefit derived from seizing their land, and they fought back, challenging their city's use of eminent domain in state supreme courts all over the U.S. Before too long, libertarians and property rights advocates also joined the fight, and by Election Day in November, ballot initiatives or constitutional amendments in 12 states asked voters and legislators to decide whether the eminent domain powers granted by the Kelo case should be limited. All but two states passed these initiatives, boosting property rights and restricting the ability of local governments to seize private property. As cases nationwide continue to challenge the Kelo decision, eminent domain and its limitations are likely to remain significant planning and development issues in the years to come. A trend appearing across the nation in cities big and small is the development or redevelopment of downtowns. These areas are gaining clout as a kind of blank canvas, ready to be rejuvenated in the name of economic development. They are also gaining popularity amongst luxury loft and condo developers, who are rapidly buying up old office buildings and warehouses in the downtowns of some of North America's biggest cities. But while this recent revival of interest in often ignored and abandoned city centers is providing needed economic growth for their cities, the low-income residents of this formerly unwanted real estate are seeing rents shoot far out of their price range. Gentrification has pushed thousands of downtown residents out of their low-rent housing, such as old warehouses, lofts, and single-room occupancy hotels. Though the cities see a downtown renaissance resulting from the influx of predominantly younger residents with money to spend, displaced lower-income residents are left looking for another place to go, and often that other place is the suburbs. In no place is the housing shortage more evident than New Orleans. More than 300,000 homes were lost as a result of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005. In the time since the devastation, efforts to house the displaced have been slow to progress. Many residents were forced to move out of town or even out of state just to find a place to live. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has reacted by sending out RV-like trailers to some residents as temporary housing, but the waits are long and the supplies are few. The architecture community has responded to the area's need by designing simple prefabricated houses, now known as Katrina cottages. These small, sturdy, storm-resistant homes have been designed to cost about $60,000 to build, a significant discount compared against the $75,000 FEMA trailers. Demand is high for these neo-traditional cottages, which can range from 400 to almost 1,000 square feet and house up to 4 people. While bureaucratic delays are hindering the dispersal of federal money to provide cottages for Katrina victims, prospective buyers from across the country are looking to get Katrina cottages for their own less-than-emergency use, such as guest houses, vacation homes, or even ski lodges. Responding to the demand, Lowe's Company, one of the nation's largest home improvement retailers, recently began selling plans and materials for the cottages in about 30 of its Gulf Region stores. The 2006 trend with possibly the most widely felt effect has been the burst of the real estate bubble. The housing market experienced a significant cool down in 2006, flipping poles from a seller's market to a buyer's. But sellers being forced to reduce their asking prices are not the biggest losers. For many Americans, their homes represent their life savings, and a large decrease in the value of homes could have the effect of turning once comfortable homeowners bankrupt. And as falling prices begin to detract from the nation's sense of wealth, consumers are expected to spend less and less on other products, which is creating a general slowdown of the economy as a whole. 2006 was what many environmentalists like to think of as the year everyone else finally started hearing what they were saying. From global warming to hybrid cars to alternative fuels, green thinking definitely got a little bit closer to going mainstream. This was especially evident in the fields of planning, architecture, and development, where green buildings saw a huge increase in use, affordability, and acceptance. Green roofs and energy-efficient designs are becoming increasingly popular with big-name architects, and these environmentally sustainable designs and methods have become almost standard in any high-profile development. The U.S. Green Building Council's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Green Building Standards, known as LEED, have become highly sought. Some cities, such as Boston, Seattle, and Salt Lake City, require LEED certification for all new public buildings. And many universities have made a pledge to operate their campuses at carbon neutrality, meaning their facilities and campuses are or will be designed to reduce as much carbon dioxide as they produce. And as the environmental effects of climate change continue to be seen, trends such as these are sure to continue. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Based in San Francisco, Jody Turner is the founder and CEO of Culture of Future and has contributed to projects for Nike, Starbucks, and IDEO, among others. She worked in graphic design for 25 years and transitioned into trend and design-based strategies. Jody's specialty is to extend the ideas of trend to fit the needs of evolving companies, consumers, and cultures. Jody, describe what you do.
I am a trend hunter, and I guess I would say that the evolved definition or the evolved term now would be the trend influencer. I kind of gather information together in ways that it makes sense in story form and intuitively, and provide it to people, consumers, and companies.
And how does one influence trends? It's interesting that you've moved from hunting trends to influencing trends. How does that work?
Well, I think it was the 80s, and then, well, it really all goes back to commodifying what is hip. And I would start in the 60s. I'm sure it happened before that. And there's a lovely book out called The History of Hip, which talks about that and how being hip in the 60s was so important to the white culture, and it ended up influencing advertising a great deal. You remember the little bug ads, et cetera. And we began to realize the hipness of things can be commodified, and advertising has been really, really important in driving this forward. And then recently, Malcolm Gladwell wrote the book Tipping Point, where we started to recognize that, the old idea of language is a virus, Laurie Anderson, and we started to recognize that we're influencing each other through language, and there became a tipping point where it became something that had a powerful energy force, and we call it trend. So for a while, we were kind of looking for those trends, those things that were hip and cool that were going to influence society, and now we realize that people, not just the ad agencies, not just the corporations, but actually people are the one beginning to drive that. And Times Person of the Year is you. And that's because we've moved into this co-creation culture. And we're starting to have kind of an amplified voice through the Internet. And as we try and look at this and the incredible changes happening with society and culture, we begin to name things. And through naming, you begin to influence. I'm called a good deal some journalists. I provide information to corporations, and as well, I'm sharing in conferences this thinking, and also getting ideas from other people. And we're beginning to create a whole new community of new think, and we're beginning to name things in order to begin to embody them and to really see their effect. So I would call trend being a part of that.
You're talking about a slice of the public, or do these things eventually make their way through the culture to the masses and have influence all across the spectrum?
Well, I think an example might be, I think it influences the masses. And of course, there are some things that have more traction than others, but I love to talk about trends that have a deeper impact. And usually it's their emotional trends. And these are the consumer-based trends. In other words, consumer humanism, or the consumer is a human being, which the consumer is. And of course, the consumer that's a human really has some very deep values. And these can be translated into trend and meaning. And we're seeing that more and more. We're seeing more trends of meaning come forth. We're seeing that we can influence the direction that society is going in through communication, through these bridges of language, through trend, and through design. So, I think that it's a powerful influence. An example might be, say, Kevin Carroll and I were working at Nike, and he was coming up with, through the basketball players, this rubber band idea around the wrist. Mm-hmm. Now, either I heard him or he heard me or someone else heard it, it's all kind of that came up with it at the same time, where I had a whole bunch of extra rubber bands, thick rubber bands left over from a project, and I started wearing them with words on them like hope, peace, love, knowing that at that time Nike needed that sort of balance. And Kevin took it into a program called Play, where we started to distribute it. He distributed it across campus, and then ultimately he ended up influencing the Armstrong group. Mm-hmm. You see these bands around. And I remember the day I saw a million yellow bands, and I'm like, wait a minute, didn't that come from? So you see that, and no one knew that we were playing, but someone saw it. Someone knew how to commodify it. And what I love about it is it was commodified for, a higher good. It inspired people. So to me, trend influence and trend is all about inspiring people to not only just do something cool and fun, which is great, and something influential and meaningful is really more, what I would enjoy.
When we think about trends, do you think there's an inordinate focus on youth culture as we attempt to identify and interpret trends?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think that as an elder, myself, I have noticed that when I talk about trends and I talk about youth trends, that I really activate a lot of other elders. Because right now, you know, the boomers are really, you know, ruling our world. And if they hear about the future and youth, there is, of course, a discomfort in that because we don't know the future and we don't know how this is going to change everything. But I love to, and when I used to travel with Rainier Evers and he asked me to do Gen Y for the youth generation and talk about it, mm-hmm. I did. I talked about it. I'm impassioned about it. I'm in love with it. I mean, this is our future, and these people, you know, we're raising them so we can have an influence as to the outcome of how this all goes. And to me, it's an exciting topic, and we want to assist young people to come into business and have a really, you know, learned and intuitive and wise mind. So this is a very important topic. And yet, I was received with, you know, quite a lot of, you know, resistance is what I would call it. And I would, I think it's because I didn't explain that I'm an elder. I look young, and I didn't explain that I'm trying to bridge communication. And so now when I present Gen Y trends, I make sure to present, you know, communication between boomer and Gen Y culture or Gen X and Gen Y culture and how we're influencing each other. And I'd actually like to talk about that today just lightly. Life is never as neat as one makes it in these structures. But, and we don't want to limit ourselves to these structures, but, you know, I talk around Europe, and I've been to Korea, and I've shared these ideas, and, of course, the structure of generation in America is very different than other countries, and so we'd have to look at other countries and cultures through those lights. But to me, it's sociological. It's the soup that we're raised in at the time. So if I am born into the boomer culture, and my parents were the silent generation, and they're silent because it was so hard to go through the depression. It was so difficult to go through World War I. We didn't hear about it, and yet that whole culture of lack drove them to teach us skills and to drive us toward materialism. And I know that I went through the 60s as well, and so what we did was we did it through idealism. And idealism was so important to us, and we didn't realize that our sense of idealism would be commodified and that we would ultimately end up serving greater ideals that who knows how, who knows why, created big politics and big corporations. So we know that this has come out of this time, and it has served a materialism in order to make sure we never lack. You know, each generation brings us forward a little bit. The boomer learned how to be, you know, to take care of themselves so that they are not a burden to greater society and they would serve the greater society. And out of that came an abundance and a wealth. And there were certain things we were not looking at because our goal was to move us forward out of nature dominance through the industrial age into dominance. And so we succeeded. And however, we had children then who are, we call Generation X, and they're the slackers or the harbingers of the creative class. And they rebelled, the smaller group rebelled against the boomers. They said, this big living, this trying to make sure we never have to feel lack is hurting us. And they didn't know the solution, but their job was to bring everyone back home into having not this overworking, not having everything be so big. So they began to do this undertone sort of living, and it became a very creative thing to have a personal language and an individualism. And so it's that psychological and sociological individuation that happened here, and they did it through creativity. So that's the iPod generation, the generation that brought us forward in, you know, wanting to have experiences close to the body. And we called them hedonists, but they were actually bringing in, you know, a sensuality back to life, enjoyment of life. We now have slow food culture as a result. We have spa culture as a result. And I can't say that they would want this, the people that rebelled and had their own idea through the indie culture, but I would say that these are the results. So, and as we evolve each generation forward, well, then what is Gen Y? Gen Y is still being defined, and if you're a conservative, you will see Gen Y as a conservative element. If you are a liberal, you will see Gen Y as a liberal element, and the reason being is that they are of a whole mind or holistic thinking. So if we have a boomer who is more left-brain driven and linear, to accomplish a task to get us moving forward through the industrial model. And then we have a right brain thinker who's more quantum and who's trying to be more creative and perhaps not fully quantum but more nature-driven and natural to our own essence and creative. And then we have the result of that, or the next generation actually, and we call it rebelling, but it's actually taking us a step forward and evolving. It becomes a whole mind. And Daniel Pink wrote this book called A Whole New Mind, and I think that it addresses somewhat what's going on in culture, which is moving from a really singular way of communicating and looking at things to a very multidimensional way of looking at doing things. And that's a whole mind. It's right and left brain thinking. It's quantum and holistic. And this is what the youth has been blessed with, to come into a society that is evolving in that direction. This is what we are doing. We are all evolving in that direction. So it takes us from the boomer and the Gen X, which is individuation and me, to a we. We're learning how to do community in new ways. This is the big thing we're getting as humans. We don't know how to do community. We kind of blew it up into a global, and now we're really focusing on the local, the idea of nearness being hip. And why is that? Because we're trying to figure out, how do we live here and now, where we are, and have an influence and an impact? And that is our new ways of trying to learn how to do community. We're exploring online with community. We're exploring with each other in local settings. And it's something that we really don't know how to do. And so I think youth are bringing these ideas in for us as they find community to be one of the most important things.
We've worked together recently on the theme of remix cities. I'm excited about the potential of this. Describe the genesis of the remixed city and its influences and what form remixed city might take.
Well, the thing I didn't talk about in the generation differences is the bridger. And that's the person between generations, and that person is strongly influential in that they see both sides and they know how to bring two ideas together at once. Now, you know, young people having the right and left brain functioning together through their use of technology and creativity at the same time, they have this sort of andism as well, this bridger sort of mind, which means they can communicate things that seem to be going in different directions. And this is how society changes. When we have two different opposing perspectives in society, Democrat, Republic, or whatever, you know, this sort of contrasting creates a friction that brings forth a lot of conversation and change. And so we call this also kind of juxtaposed or paradoxical people who can resolve those sort of seemingly opposites and make something of value from that is remixing. And it's, you know, it started with Gen X wanting to do some really new creative music and bringing old and new, because they're very much into reinventing vintage or reinvintage. You know, they're really into honoring heritage and yet bringing forth new ideas, not having it be the way it was. And so then we have a remixing. So then we begin to see society as remixing everything. And it's because we are inundated with so much information, so many options, and the way to resolve that is to remix it. Now we have a lot of different cultures living together. We have a lot of different ideas coming together. We have a lot of options now. And so we end up solving it by bringing it together in new ways, and we call it remixing. So that is a great solution for when we know cities are becoming their own. Cities are the new countries. So since people are moving to the cities again, and we're seeing that we want to use space wisely, and we want to not only have creative ways of working with the young coming into cities as well as the elders coming into cities, we realize we have to have a remix sort of perspective, taking a lot of different ideas that seem opposing and bringing them together in ways that create kind of a creative seed. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You are speaking at the Apple Store in San Francisco January 17th on how to integrate influential trend practices into business and design. Tell me what you plan to say.
Well, when I do presentations, I love to have a lot of different visuals. I am blessed to be able to meet a lot of wonderful designers, so I love to show varieties of work that really kind of almost overwhelm us and inspire us, you know, permission giving. So visually, I love to feed a feast. And sometimes it frightens people because there's so much going on. Yes, there is. Join in. You know, use your mind to really feed yourself. I do blogs for different companies to help feed internally their companies. Feed the workers because, you know, a consumer will know when a product doesn't have that sort of passion to it. And, you know, we keep encouraging different companies to really feed the workers. It's a new sort of model. Treat your worker like an entrepreneur inside or an entrepreneur and allow them to, I think Best Buy is a really good example of what's going on with that sort of entrepreneur. And allow the product then to come out with this new sort of energy. It's going to be more connected to society and culture. So I think I'll be talking about those sorts of things.
When you say treat your employee like an entrepreneur, what does that really mean?
It means, well, that's a tough one, isn't it? Because I work with corporations and I work as an entrepreneur inside of corporations. And you have to honor the structure and you have to honor the heritage of the brand. And yet we do know that hierarchy of brand is not necessarily viewed kindly by the new consumer. So you have to begin to take the hierarchy and begin to have kind of cross-sharing or more organic form internally. So IDEO is a perfect example of that, and IDEO is hired to come into companies and to help them have this sort of non-focus group sort of approach. A lot of structure, but structured toward creative outcome. And this is by trying to break up having, you know, cubes, having the people cross-share in new ways, having them, you know, fed through creating trust structures in new ways, instead of always having to just cover your butt and, make it through the day. You know, actually set people up in more circular or matrix sort of formations to, and they don't have to be there all the time, but just create pods. We have, say, Clay Street in Procter & Gamble is doing this, or Project Platypus inside of Mattel. And IDEO is doing this in a lot of companies, and their book, 10 Faces of Innovation, has examples of how they've helped companies do this.
Jody, one last question. As you think about your career in this world, moving from graphic design now to helping companies understand the implications of trends, if you think about what the biggest revelation has been for you in this time.
The biggest revelation to me is that we influence each other greatly by the things that we say. I am amazed at the things that I've said to people, and then I will see something on television, and I know that it's come from conversations. I'm amazed at the things people tell me and how that sends me in a totally different direction. And of course, you have to really have a filtering mind. You have to know what is important, and with time, you can really train yourself to do this, and it doesn't take much. You just have to go toward the heart of what really matters in everything that you're doing, what has the energy feed and core, and you build upon that. And that's a fierce way of living because you're not protected. You're not doing a linear thing. I am reinventing myself all the time, and that is a dynamic way to live. It's unpredictable. And I find it to be, I set out to do one thing in my business, and now I'm doing many other things. But it's because I look at each problem, and it's like a walking think tank approach. What does this situation need? I'm not trying to apply my model. We want to make sure that many voices are heard, and the younger you are, the easier it is for you to filter piles of information unless you constantly allow yourself to work on that and open to receive and be influenced.
Jody, it was fun talking to you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Jody Turner is founder and CEO of Culture of Future. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Money can't buy happiness, or you can't take it with you, are two sayings often expressed when people consider priorities for their lives. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith takes a look at material wealth and how it might fit in the new American dream.
There are two leisure classes in America, one with lots of money, the other with just enough. Which is to say that millions of us feel we have plenty, even though our personal net worths are far short of millions. Not that money doesn't matter, only that for many people, the threshold above which money ceases to be the thing that matters most isn't that high. In the mid-1990s, before the dot-com boom, the Merck Family Fund commissioned a nationwide survey and found that 95% believe we are too materialistic, and 82% believe we consume more than we need. Even more interesting was the finding that 28% of Americans reported they had voluntarily taken a pay cut in order to have a job that gives them more time and more balance in their lives. This is a remarkably large number of people saying that they have made the deliberate choice to make do and have more of a life with less. Surely, this is one of the more telling insights into our collective prosperity over the past several decades. In the midst of so much, there is a widespread willingness to live with less. The American dream has always been one of making it, and of making as much of it as possible. What, then, do we make of so many Americans disavowing any interest in being filthy rich? It's not sour grapes. Instead, there seems to be a growing sentiment that just as clothes make the man, so too do riches make one's character. More and more people see extreme wealth as unbecoming. Whether or not we want to be wealthy, we can all agree that there is a certain cosmic folly in obsessing about bigger houses, faster cars, and shinier baubles. Indeed, it's hard not to feel that something is amiss when we read news stories about Silicon Valley or Vail, Colorado, or Hawaii, where prices are so high that middle-income workers can't make ends meet. There are no limits to ownership, but there are limits to consumption and time. No matter how much we accumulate, there is never any increase in the amount that we can consume, use, or enjoy. A new American dream is taking shape, one that is still about making it, but making it with less, not with more. Those who don't aspire to a big material footprint are no longer out of step with the mainstream, but rather are blazing a new trail for the rest of us. Time spent accumulating more than enough is not necessarily time well spent. So many people have decided that in getting by with a little less, they can get a lot more out of life. In fact, it is the only dream that guarantees self-determination and freedom from the regimented frenzy of the rat race of more, more, more. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.